Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. My name is Andreas Alexandru, and I'm an audit partner here at GRF. I'm very excited to welcome Jeff Tannenbaum, who's a managing partner at Tannenbaum Law Group, for a fireside chat, Mitigating ESG and DEI Legal Risks for Not-for-Profits. Jeff Tannenbaum is one of the nation's leading nonprofit attorneys and is also an accomplished author, lecturer, commentator, and expert witness on nonprofit legal matters. Jeff counsels senior management and boards of directors of his not-for-profit clients on the broad array of legal and sensitive business and governance issues, including those related to ESG and DEI. Jeff, thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
All right, so we'll just get started. We've got some questions that we want to get through, and I'll just start out with the first one. Ever since the U.S. Supreme Court's college admissions decision last June, we've seen a rash of legal challenges to a wide array of DEI-related initiatives. What legal risks should nonprofits be concerned about in the employment and HR area, and what can they do to mitigate those risks?
All right, so there's a lot here. I know we have limited time. First, Trevor, thanks for your great comments and remarks, and thank you also for getting us caught up on time. That was impressive to get through it all. I think only 2 minutes over, so I appreciate that. And some of what I'm going to talk about relates to what you talked about, and there's definitely some tension here. Not Jeff Tannenbaum created tension, but tension created by the law. Don't shoot the messenger, but we're going to talk about some of that here today. So, last June, the U.S. Supreme Court decided in a pair of cases that are consolidated into a single ruling involving Harvard University and the University of North Carolina. The U.S. Supreme Court issued a pretty significant and sweeping decision that essentially rejects race-conscious admissions in higher education. The decision itself was limited to higher education. It does not, by its terms, by its text, apply outside of the admissions process in higher education. But many of us at the time read the decision and the rationale behind the decision and recognized that using the logic behind the majority's rationale in the Supreme Court decision, that it likely had potential impact far beyond higher education. And sure enough, what we have seen since then, almost a year later, is a rash of litigation that is currently working its way through the courts, some by some of the same, actually, organizations and individuals, kind of right-leaning conservative nonprofit organizations that were the ones behind the plan of what's called Students for Fair Admissions. Some of the same individuals have brought litigation in a number of areas, but primarily in the employment area as well as in the contracting area, using the rationale behind the Supreme Court's decision to challenge certain. Let's talk. You asked Andreas about employment, so let's focus on the employment area first. Challenging kind of longstanding precedent that allows certain conduct in the employment setting without making it illegal, but challenging that kind of longstanding, decades-long rationale. Like, for instance, right now, the current state of the law, at least federal law, says that in the employment setting, an employer is lawfully allowed to take race, for instance, into account if members of a racial minority were previously excluded from a job category in that employer, or to remove obstacles such as unconscious bias that prevent employers from having a more diverse workforce. Engaging in those sorts of conduct are lawful under current law. Engaging in other sorts of conduct, having, quotas or set-asides for certain underrepresented groups, is not lawful under the current state of the law. But the current state of the law may well change. And some of the litigation that's been filed right now is designed to try to have the U.S. Supreme Court change the law in that area to make things like I just described illegal going forward. And it's basically on two different grounds. One is, I won't bore you with the legal details, but one is on constitutional grounds, essentially the 14th Amendment, equal protection grounds. And the other is on what's called statutory construction, how the court interprets a statute. In this case, primarily, we're talking about Title VII of the Federal Civil Rights Act. And as a result of this, essentially, the rationale, the thinking behind the arguments is that if And however well-meaning an employer, and obviously here we're talking about nonprofit employers, however well-meaning an employer's desire is to, you know, try to promote racial minorities that were previously excluded from or underrepresented in certain job categories, or to remove obstacles like unconscious bias that prevent a more diverse workforce, that if that has the effect of discriminating, of essentially reverse discrimination. Say discriminating against white men or whatnot, for instance, that's illegal. And that's the rationale behind it. We don't know how these court cases are going to come out, but there are a lot of folks, a lot of kind of legal observers and experts in this area that believe it's very possible that ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court may tighten the rules in this area and make it more difficult for employers to engage in those sorts of practices. You know, so for instance, one of Trevor's suggestions in his comments, number six, I think, was offering talent development programs for underrepresented staff members. If a, you know, certain talent, and then this is, by the way, a common practice in a lot of nonprofits. I spent my whole career doing nothing but representing nonprofits, including providing a lot of employment-related advice. And for years, these kind of programs were never on questionable, seemingly never on questionable legal ground. Well, they now are. They potentially are. And so if you have a talent development program that is only limited to certain underrepresented groups of individuals, that is potentially, I'd say potentially, legally suspect. And the challenge that a lot of nonprofit employers are dealing with these days is that they're So many of them, like I'm sure so many of your organizations, are very much committed to these sorts of programs, to these initiatives, to creating a more diverse workforce, to promoting and kind of pumping up underrepresented staff members into future leadership roles and whatnot. But if you are doing it in a way that allegedly discriminates against other groups of individuals, that's potentially illegal. Now, the question here, and why I say so many are struggling, is like it's a cart before the horse issue. Right now, that U.S. Supreme Court decision from last June does not apply in the employment setting. Yet, nonprofit organizations, as well as for-profit employers, are being sued right now because of some of these programs. So I get the question all the time, you know, we have this program. Because it's risky and we could get sued over it, should we modify it or eliminate it or open it up to everyone or change the criteria? So it's not based on race or ethnicity, but it's based on, you know, maybe just having a disadvantaged upbringing or things like that. And that's the real challenge and question. Now, of course, in the end, if the U.S. Supreme Court changes the law of the land, then it's going to be a different story. Then you're going to have no choice. But right now, and that takes some time, things have to go through at the federal level, the district courts, and then the appellate courts, and then up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And it'll get there, but it's going to take some time. But it's a real challenge. But I will say that these sorts of kind of staff leadership acceleration programs or internship programs that are only open to members of certain underrepresented minority groups are probably on pretty significant questionable legal ground and something you should work with your legal counsel to take a very close look at. One other thing I wanted to mention relating to this, and this was kind of number seven in Trevor's list of suggestions. And by the way, all of the other suggestions in there, for the most part, to me, did not really raise any significant legal concerns under at least the current state of the law and where the law seems to be going. And so I think this is a really important point that I don't think even under the rationale of the Supreme Court's June decision last year, I don't think we're ever going to get to a point, I can't envision it, where DEI programs on their face are all illegal, at least at the federal level. I'm going to talk about the states in a second, at the federal level. And all of those other things that Trevor talked about, to me, don't really raise any questionable legal concerns or risks. But you know, I just talked about one that could be. But another thing to keep in mind, and this is at the state level, and I don't need to tell any of you that we have a real divide in our country between red and blue, and in some cases purple states. But what we are seeing is that in the red, I'm talking politically red states, led by Florida and Texas, that there is a trend that we are seeing to ban. Now, this is not in all cases to ban DEI programs per se, although in some cases involving higher ed, that actually is the case in the law of the land in states like Florida and Texas and some others as well. But Florida actually, to my knowledge, the law is rapidly evolving in this area in different states. But Florida, to my knowledge, is the only state so far that has banned DEI trainings for private employers in Florida, which, by the way, also includes employers that are based in another state but have remote employees working from Florida. So if you are based, if you're a nonprofit employer based in Florida or you have remote employees working in Florida, it is illegal for you to offer DEI trainings to those Florida-based employees or to all of your employees if you're based in Florida. So far, those sorts of laws in other states have been limited either to public sector, like government agency employers, as well as to higher ed, where there are kind of state colleges and universities. But a lot of people expect that these laws may expand and broaden in Texas and in other states and other red states across the country. So it's definitely something that you very much need to keep an eye out on. And if that's the, you know, if you have a Florida-based employee and you're doing DEI trainings, you need to exclude those employees and force them to not participate in those DEI trainings. It is blatantly against the law in those states. Whether you like it or don't, and I'm sure that for most or all of you, you would say you don't like that. That's just the law of the land. That's not one of these cart before the horse issues. That's something that you just have to be very cognizant of.
That was actually very timely. There was a question that came from the audience before you got into the state issue about any advice on handling DEI efforts in the face of general opposition in certain states, and what are companies doing, and what are the terms that they're what are they changing? And so the timing of your answer was very, very timely.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a private nonprofit, which most or all of you are, I'm sure, you know, right now, unless you're based in Florida, you have a Florida-based employee. It's not going to be illegal for you to conduct these trainings, but you definitely want to keep an eye on how the law evolves on that area. But for under federal law, and in all the issues that I talked about earlier, I think you really have to be. You can't just say a DEI program is legal or illegal. It just doesn't work like that. It's all, what are the elements of it? How is it structured? How is it carried out? Like I said, the majority of all the points that Trevor suggested to me didn't really raise any legal concerns. Of course, how some of them might be executed could potentially raise legal concerns, but on their face, they didn't. And even in, you know, like I said, if you want to offer some sort of a staff acceleration talent development program for certain underrepresented staff members, just like we're seeing is happening in higher ed, you can use some proxies for things like race and ethnicity. You know, you can require, like a lot of colleges now and universities, they can't give any kind of preferential treatment to certain underrepresented groups, but they can have applicants, college applicants, write essays that talk about the hardship and the things they've overcome in their lives. Some of those folks are going to be part of certain protected characteristics, you know, from a federal civil rights perspective, some are not. But that's kind of the way that I would recommend if you want to fully mitigate any legal risk in this area and eliminate these sorts of programs that are on questionable legal ground. Don't get rid of them altogether, but reform them to focus on things like that, as opposed to just, you know, the color of their skin or whatnot. That's just a suggestion. And then, of course, the other things that are currently lawful now, things like taking race into account in the hiring process, if, you know, certain racial minorities were previously excluded from the job, that's currently the law of the land. That may change. But like what Trevor suggested, trying to mitigate the idea of culture fit in the hiring process, and trying to get, you know, really focus on, you know, not that personality doesn't matter, and, you know, in the hiring process, of course it does, but really focusing on qualifications and other things like that to try to weed out any unconscious bias, is a much safer way to hopefully try to accomplish some of the same goals.
Very good. Thank you so much, Jeff. Very insightful. We have another question. Beyond the employment setting, are there other DEI-related risks, legal risks, that nonprofits should be aware of and guard against?
Yeah, so this also very much is an area that implicates nonprofits. And we've already seen some lawsuits filed against nonprofits in this area. So what we are talking about here are forgetting about the employment setting. Everything I just talked about so far was in the employment and HR setting based on employment law. Now what we're talking about are contracts. So a lot of people don't know this, but back in 1866, when Congress passed the first Civil Rights Act, Civil Rights Act of 1866, this is after the end of the Civil War, that law included Section 1981, which was where the whole act was designed largely to protect the rights of people that were freed from enslavement. Well, not the whole act, but this section was designed to protect former slaves and was basically says it is illegal to discriminate in contracting and entering into contracts on the basis of someone's race. So first off, Section 1981 is solely limited to race, not other protected characteristics, just on race. And it has been around since all of that time. Many people didn't know about it or maybe discovering it more recently because of some recent litigation, but it makes it illegal to discriminate on the basis of race, on any race. It doesn't specify minority race, racial categories or whatnot, just discrimination on the basis of race, period. So you can probably see where this is going. Some of these same groups that brought the college admissions cases last year have filed litigation against certain for-profit and nonprofit programs. And again, this is not the employment setting, but programs that limit those programs to individuals who fall into certain minority categories. And when I say programs in the nonprofit setting, think things like fellowship programs, scholarship programs, internship programs. Now, internships are often going to be employees, but not always. But think of these because all of these typically require a contract, right? I advise, our nonprofit clients on this. Yes, if you're going to give someone a scholarship or fellowship and you're going to have certain requirements, you're going to give them money, you're going to have a contract in place to ensure that the monies are being used in the way they're supposed to. What happens if they don't do what they're supposed to? All the other things, you're always going to have a contract. A lot of law firms, especially bigger law firms, like where I came from, have programs that provide for certain either like sometimes are internal like promotion, staff acceleration type programs, and others are for folks that they want to bring into the firm to help promote certain minority categories. Lawsuits have been filed against some of those programs as well. In all of these cases, claiming that these programs are illegal because they are limited only to people of certain races, along with certain other protected characteristics like LGBTQ+ and folks with disabilities. And we've seen these lawsuits being filed claiming it's essentially the same reverse discrimination argument, that it discriminates against, for instance, white people or Asian people or others on the basis of their race and that they are therefore illegal. And again, we don't know how these cases are going to end up. They're still relatively early on. Litigation takes a long time, has to work its way through the district courts, the appellate court. There is no doubt in my mind that one or more of these cases will end up at the U.S. Supreme Court. And, based on the rationale of last June's decision, I think it's not at all out of the realm of possibility, perhaps some would say more likely than not, that the U.S. Supreme Court may find these programs to be a violation of Section 1981 of that 1866 Civil Rights Act. So again, you have that same question. Like literally these days, nonprofits are being sued over these programs. So if you have one of these programs and it's limited in that way, do you have some legal risk? Of course you do. There's no question about it. Now, how you mitigate risk, and that's how I make a living, is helping nonprofits mitigate risk. It doesn't always mean having zero risk. right? Every nonprofit tends to have a risk continuum on how much risk they're willing to take in certain areas, and then factoring in things like, do we have insurance that would cover a claim and things like that, which, by the way, most of these, well, certainly the employment cases would be covered by insurance. On these contracting claims, it's actually a lot less clear whether insurance would cover, because, for instance, like direct nonprofit directors and officers liability insurance policies don't cover breach of contract claims. I don't think this would be considered a breach of contract claim, but it's less clear whether there would be insurance coverage for these sorts of things. But that's what has to factor into your risk analysis. Like, I work a lot with Melissa, who's part of this program at GRF, on ERM, enterprise risk management, and how to mitigate risk. And so these are the kinds of things you have to factor in. But I will say, if you want to mitigate that risk, again, like I said, in the employment setting, one thing you can do is, which a lot of nonprofits have already started doing, which is changing those criteria. They're not getting rid of the programs, but changing it to be, you know, based on essays that explain how someone overcame a hardship in their life or difficult times or whatnot to get to where they are, and basing the eligibility criteria based on those factors as opposed to just race. I'm not saying that you have to do this, but if you're cognizant of trying to mitigate risk, then I think that's something you have to keep in mind.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. We've got a couple more minutes. There's an audience question that I'm going to pull into this. And it's from an individual that works for a government agency, a foreign government agency. And they're watching closely the ESG development. And the question is, do you think that the coming regulations will ask for more data monitoring and disclosures on the DEI level? So that's the question.
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, first off, and I want to tie back to, I joined this program around 12:15 Eastern, and I heard both of the first two speakers, and the first one, you know, talking, it was really focused on the for-profit corporate world, and SEC regulation and things like that. But I'm presuming with an eye toward the fact that a lot of nonprofit organizations, which is this universe, are voluntarily adopting certain ESG initiatives, particularly in the environmental and conservation and climate space. And while, you know, nonprofits are not regulated by the FEC, they're not currently mandated by any federal or state programs in this regard to disclose certain data about you know, their impact on climate and whatnot. If you are voluntarily doing this, you know, I think that those federal, like SEC type requirements, are instructive, informative, in that, you know, I wrote this article, what did I call it? Mitigating the Legal Risks of Nonprofits, ESG and DEI Programs. And I talked about a whole bunch of different kind of categories of legal risk, some of which I just talked about here today. But another category was misrepresentation and greenwashing. And, you know, there's always been the case that nonprofits, like any organization in the country, if you publicly go out and misrepresent or overstate your nonprofit's ESG performance, that could lead to legal claims of greenwashing or otherwise engaging in deceptive or misleading conduct. This could lead to, you know, if you're a membership organization, member backlash, certainly reputational damage, potentially even regulatory enforcement by, say, state attorneys general and private litigation. And so while I am not at all suggesting that you run away from these sorts of initiatives, what I am saying is that if you are going to publicly make claims that might have the effect of driving more employees to you or driving more donor dollars or grant dollars or other things to you, that you need to be sure that you can substantiate those claims. That's something, nothing new. I've been advising on nonprofits on claim substantiation for years. You know, I've been advising clients, certain, you know, that are advocates in certain initiatives or whatever, and making claims publicly in ads and social media and whatnot, that if you're going to make a claim that your industry is doing better, you know, from an environmental perspective in this or this, or that, you know, your product is safer or healthier or whatever else, you know, your industry, your profession's product, or whatever the issue is that you're out there publicly advocating for, you have to have substantiated data to be able to support that. And that applies in the ESG area as well. So I think that's really important. Now, that was just a little background, but on the specific question, you know, do I think that there's regulations coming asking for more data monitoring disclosures on DEI-related issues? I don't see that happening at the federal level anytime soon. I could see that happening at the state level, particularly certain red states that really want to, you know, essentially kill DEI initiatives of every type. And regulation can come in a lot of different forms, and I could see, I could certainly see something like that. I see another question. Does the contract litigation, I assume we're talking about the Section 1981 stuff, also impact procurement policies that talk about prioritizing or including women and minority-owned businesses? Well, remember, like I said, Section 1981 only applies to race, not gender. So if there was, but yes, procurement policies, which involve the letting of contracts, right? You know, you have a procurement policy, you go out and you procure services, and then you enter into a contract for those services. If those contracts are only limited to minority-owned businesses, I think absolutely that raises the same risks. Now, if the contracts were limited only to women-owned businesses, I don't think that raises any legal risks under Section 1981. So I know it's a difficult thing to get your arms around. It's not a way that we've been thinking in the past, but I will tell you this litigation is also affecting government, federal government, small business programs. And there are a number of them right now, even under this administration, which are making changes to their programs to try to guard against this legal risk for these exact same reasons.
Very good, Jeff. Thank you so much. As always, a pleasure hearing your insights. And we are right at time, just about right at time, 1:15. We're going to take a 10-minute break here, and we'll be back at 1:25.
Thank you for listening to the GRF on the Go podcast. Visit our website at grfcpa.com for more information about the services we provide, the industries we serve, or to request a quote.